Hello, and welcome to On Science, a weekly journey into the heart and soul of the science desk here at NPR. I'm Christopher Joyce, and this week, again, we've allowed one of our editors, Allison Richards, to come back and join us.
Hi, Chris.
Good to have you. So what would you like to talk about?
I have to say, one of my pieces of the week this week was your piece on the Neanderthals. Because, you know, like everybody else, I've got this picture book image of this heavy, brutish guy, you know, with big forehead, wide nose, you know, pretty much too macho even for me. And your piece showed maybe we are rehabilitating Neanderthals a little bit.
Well, scientists in Germany are about to shed some light on just how close a relative Neanderthals were to us. And let's hear the story. Neanderthals may not have been our direct ancestors, but before they died out 30,000 years ago or so, they were our closest living relatives. Svante Paabo, who led the German team from the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, says the genome map is immensely important.
The attraction of getting the Neanderthal genome is that it's our closest relative in all categories.
And, he says, mapping the Neanderthal code will eventually tell us as much about humans as it will about Neanderthals. The map started with a fragment of bone, carefully extracted from a fossilized Neanderthal skeleton from a cave in Croatia. The bone was over 33,000 years old. The scientists spent 2.5 years extracting DNA from that bone and a few other precious specimens. This week, they've announced that they've mapped most of the genome. What does it tell them? At a press conference in Leipzig, Paabo says it tells them when human and Neanderthal populations split apart.
And we diverged maybe something just like 300,000 years ago from the Neanderthal.
Genetically, though, humans and Neanderthals started drifting away from a common ancestor long before that. And now scientists can get a before and after look at how these two close relatives changed once they diverged from each other genetically.
So what we can now do is look at all those genetic changes on the lineage to us, and divide them up among those that happened before we diverged from the Neanderthals and those that happened after.
Neanderthals and humans turn out to be less than 1% different genetically. Among the genes they apparently shared before the split is one that creates an intolerance in adults for lactose in milk. It was only in the past 10,000 years or so that modern adult humans, mostly in Europe, evolved a tolerance for lactose, according to Paabo. Another possibility, the Neanderthal map showed features that suggest Neanderthals and modern humans might have shared a gene thought to confer language ability. Team member and biologist Ed Green says those are the kind of discoveries the map could reveal once it's finished.
The big, longer-term goal is to use the Neanderthal to find the changes that happened in our genome very recently, even after we split from Neanderthals. And these then will be candidates for human-specific adaptation.
It gives us clues to what makes us peculiar, what makes us human.
Yes, because Neanderthals are our closest extinct relatives, they kind of define what makes us human.
Anthropologist Rick Potts, who runs the Human Origins Program at the Smithsonian Institution, says he'd like to compare Neanderthal and human genes that control the brain.
Did they think differently? Those parts of the brain that relate to human social life and social interaction, were they different from modern humans?
The new data could cast light on another controversial hypothesis about Neanderthals, whether they interbred with humans. So far, the team says there's no significant evidence in the genome that they did. The team announced their findings at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and they plan to publish their results soon.
Listening to that piece, Chris, which was great, I mean, what was the challenge of presenting that kind of, you know, actually pretty arcane scientific advance?
What's left out is the hard part, actually, in something like this, especially with the way the molecular biology is sort of taking over paleoanthropology. So much of what we're finding out now about, the family of Homo sapiens is really mathematical. It's looking at these billions of base pairs, these units of DNA, and comparing them among different species, living and extinct, and then turning that into something that people can understand about what came first, what came second, and how we're related. It's fabulous new science, but trying to understand it and communicate it is really the tough part.
Well, I think you did a pretty good job.
Always oversimplified, however. Well, perhaps you caught a story during the week that Nell Greenfield Boyce wrote about NASA, about, in fact, a video that some people at NASA made, not an official video, something quite unofficial, right? Now, it wasn't part of the massive NASA public relations machine, was it?
Well, it wasn't part of the public relations machine, but it wasn't like they just made this unofficially. I mean, this was part of an official program they were part of, trying to look at, you know, reasons why good ideas at NASA might get ignored. It was sort of like a management kind of a brainstorming project.
How did you find this video?
One NASA manager, Wayne Hale, has a blog. He used to head the space shuttle program. He now has a blog. And so he thought the video was, as he put it, extraordinarily funny and not at all funny. And so he posted this up on his blog and then wrote about it.
Let's hear it.
An astronaut named Andy Thomas put this little movie together. He shot it with a borrowed camera and produced it on his home computer. The actors are people who work for NASA or its contractors, and the video is getting a lot of attention in the space community. It was recently shown to senior managers at a retreat. One NASA manager has called it, quote, extraordinarily funny and not at all funny. This is Law and Order. At Johnson Space Center in Houston, that is, a young engineer has a great new idea. Her supervisor's office, 1 year ago.
So, I've been thinking about this better way to design the spacecraft, and here are some sketches of what...
Her supervisor is immediately dubious.
Wow, this is a pretty significant change from the way the project office is doing things.
The supervisor raises one objection after another. There's no requirement for this. We've never done anything like this. Other managers just dismiss the idea.
We don't think this idea is technically sound.
Well, okay, but the present way we're doing this is actually flawed. I've looked at that. And honestly, it's way too expensive. A matter of fact, our current approach is just really bad engineering.
You know, that might be, but it doesn't matter. I can't afford to care about that.
He gestures to a huge flow chart on the wall.
My job is to make sure the project follows this plan.
The engineer gets increasingly frustrated as she's told, hey, we really appreciate what you're trying to do here, but this isn't what you're supposed to be doing.
How can I possibly contribute and be innovative if I have to ask for approval for everything I want to say?
We're not talking about that here. We don't want to repress dissenting views or innovation like this. That's not how we operate.
As he says that, a video caption asks, are you sure? That's just one of the questions posed by the film's creator, who says this story may be fiction, but it's based on people's real experiences.
What I hope will happen is that people will take an inward critical look at themselves and the way they've been doing things and perhaps reassess.
Astronaut Andy Thomas wrote the script while working on a team project organized by Johnson Space Center's senior management. The team was asked to look for barriers to innovation, reasons why new ideas get ignored.
I wanted to try and capture those in a way that people would understand, in a way that would resonate.
So he didn't want to just do a PowerPoint presentation or write a boring document. He says he wasn't exactly sure how the team's video would be received.
Because these are, after all, fairly sensitive issues, and they're important issues. I have to say I'm very gratified by the upper management of the agency who made a point that this should go public so that people could see it.
One reason these issues are sensitive is that similar problems at NASA have been linked to two space shuttle disasters. Before those accidents, some engineers identified potential dangers, but their ideas were new, and managers didn't understand their importance. Howard McCurdy is a space policy expert with American University. He's written about how NASA's original high-tech culture evolved into a more bureaucratic one. He says what struck him in the video was that managers didn't have a technical discussion. Instead, they talked about administrative things.
That's not the kind of agency you would like to have running rocket programs. It might be okay for Social Security check disbursement, but it sure isn't going to be good for rocket science.
The video ends with its fictional engineer at a new job at Google, pitching another idea.
And, you know, I think the public's going to be really excited.
Her new manager is excited, too. He offers all kinds of support.
In my mind, my responsibility is work for you.
In fact, he says, her idea is so good, they could probably even sell it to NASA. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Now, Nell, that story was broadcast on Monday, and at the beginning of the week, You were wondering whether there was going to be another story to do, and we're looking around for things, and then, bam, on Wednesday, the story of the colliding communication satellites broke. Can you just remind me what happened?
Yeah. So these satellites actually collided on Tuesday around noon Eastern time, which means when I was having my lunch on Tuesday, wondering what the next story I would do would be, basically some satellites were obligingly colliding over Siberia. So the deal here is this is a commercial company's communication satellite, an Iridium satellite, and then also a defunct satellite owned by the Russian government, and they smacked into each other about 500 miles up above the Earth and scattered like two big clouds of space junk into orbit around the Earth.
And when did you hear about it?
The news broke fairly late on Wednesday.
Boom goes London, boom Paris, more room for you and more room for me. When the satellites start to fall.
Well, it would be okay if they fell, but the problem is that, lots of pieces of them are now still in orbit around the Earth and will be for a very long time, where they can potentially run into other stuff like the Hubble Space Telescope or the International Space Station or other, extremely expensive public space assets that we all have up there.
Where are those force fields when you need them?
Yeah, well, on TV, I guess.
Well, thanks for coming to talk to us.
Sure.
Well, another of the breaking news stories we had to report on this week was the ruling by the Vaccine Court, as it's colloquially known, which will affect thousands of parents who believe that their children developed autism after being vaccinated. And with me here is John Hamilton. He was the reporter who's been covering autism and the science of autism for a long time. And John, you got news that this ruling was about to come the night before, is that right?
Got a definite news the night before. I've been hearing for weeks that they were prepared to make a ruling, and then the night before I got news from some groups that were actually scheduling press conferences to respond to the ruling, suggesting they knew for sure it was coming.
Well, I mean, what was the background to all this? Because this court, special court, was set up, back in 2002?
This all has to do with a fund that was set up by the government to compensate people who were injured by vaccines. They never had autism in mind when they set this up. This is for other injuries. Sometimes people have allergic reactions to vaccines. And the idea was that all the companies that make vaccines were going to leave the market if they didn't set up some system where they weren't being sued all the time every time somebody had something bad happen. Then in about 2002 or thereabouts, a number of parents of children with autism said, well, our children have been injured by these vaccines. In fact, that's why we think they have autism. And so we're going to seek compensation through this fund. And there were so many, there are now about 5,000 of those families who are seeking that type of compensation, that the court that adjudicates these procedures set up a special court to do nothing but try to figure out the autism issue. And that's what this ruling was about.
So even though scientific study after scientific study has been saying there is no link between vaccination and autism, now the ruling is they agree with that.
What happened here was a federal court agreed with science that there is just no link between autism and vaccines, whether it's from the preservative used in the vaccines or from a reaction to the vaccine itself. They could not find a link.
Okay, well, let's hear the piece.
About 5,000 families have been waiting for today's ruling from a special court set up by the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. The special court was asked to rule on three test cases to help decide whether kids with autism should be included in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Today's ruling makes that unlikely. In all three cases, the court ruled against the families. Rebecca Estep has a son with autism. She's also the national manager of a group called Talk About Curing Autism.
Today's tough. I've tried to stay optimistic all of these years. We filed our case in 2002. And I thought our best shot in the government was through the judicial branch. And this is really a blow today.
Scientists who listened to testimony from the proceedings weren't surprised by the ruling. Roy Richard Grinker is an anthropologist at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., who does research on autism. He also has a teenage daughter with the disorder. Grinker says that during the proceedings, the government called on many of the world's best-known autism scientists. The plaintiffs, on the other hand,
called chemists and pediatrician with limited research experience, people who were not internationally recognized as people who'd had a lot of experience either treating or researching autism.
The parents testified that their children became autistic only after being vaccinated. But Grinker says the government's scientific witnesses found evidence to the contrary.
When you look at the home movies and you look at the clinical records, as the witnesses did for the government, you see repeatedly that there were major issues prior to the vaccines, either a child not making eye contact or not communicating, not being social, having repetitive behaviors, and so on.
The family's case depended on two theories. The first was that measles virus in the MMR vaccine could trigger autism in some children. It was an idea put forth in a paper by a British researcher named Andrew Wakefield in the late 1990s. But during the vaccine court's investigations, most of Wakefield's co-authors retracted the paper. Paul Offit, a vaccine expert at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, says the retraction came after an embarrassing revelation.
They did it because they found that he had, in fact, been given $800,000 by a personal injury lawyer to basically launder these plaintiffs' claims through a medical journal.
The plaintiff's other major theory was that a vaccine preservative called thimerosal, which contains mercury, was causing autism. But Offit says that just before the vaccine court got going in 2002...
thimerosal was removed from all vaccines given to young children. And despite that, there has, if anything, been over the last 8 years an increase in autism.
The vaccine court is still set to rule on three more autism test cases. But Stephen Sugarman, a law professor at Berkeley, doesn't expect a different result.
The claims under the vaccine compensation program now are pretty clearly doomed.
So, John, hundreds of pages and hundreds of scientific studies were examined by these special judges. Do you think this is the end of it?
Well, no. All the people who are in this court have the right now to go to other courts and sue vaccine manufacturers. This is not over.
I guess another example of how the two worlds of science and the law just don't seem to get along very well.
Families are very much looking at anecdotes, the power of a story where a mother says, my child was fine until they got the vaccines, and then I saw my child change, and I know that is the vaccines, versus the scientists who are looking at groups of thousands of people, some of whom got vaccines, some who didn't, not seeing any change in autism rates. It's epidemiology versus anecdote, and in the public perception, anecdote usually wins.
Yeah, and the rules of evidence in the two realms of the world, the courtroom and the laboratory are just different.
They are different.
So there'll be plenty more stories for you to keep reporting on it.
I expect to be busy, yes.
Well, the gap between science and what people want to believe or not believe has actually been something we've been dealing with a lot this week, because it's been Darwin's 200th birthday, and evolution is still something that science believes in and quite a lot of people don't.
So we have Joe Palka, who's just done a passel of stories about Darwin for the anniversary of Darwin's birth, who has been to England and also to Kansas to talk to people about Darwin. Joe, before we hear your piece, why don't you tell us a little bit about the different kind of approaches people take, the different kind of attitudes that people have toward Darwin in the two parts of the world?
Oh, well, clearly in England, it's Darwin, Darwin, Darwin. I mean, there's... everywhere you look, there's somebody's having a festival or a ceremony or a BBC program, or the Royal Mint has a £2 special coin, and the Royal Mail has a stamp set. So it's, you know, obviously he's a hometown boy and he's been embraced. And if he's controversial, you don't hear much about it. You know, here you do hear headlines about should we be teaching evolution or should we be teaching alternatives to evolution, whatever those are called these days, intelligent design. It's the other direction. It's the other extreme almost in England. It's like if you dare to challenge Darwin and the importance of his work, you're ostracized.
Yeah, well, but you did go to Kansas anyway, actually, where there is a first edition of Darwin's Origin of Species?
Yeah, there's, I mean, I'm actually involved in a project to look for what happened to all the 1,250 copies of the first edition of On the Origin of Species as a sort of a, just a sort of an idea of a framework for understanding how this idea got circulated around the world in the days before internet or telephones or fax machines or any of those things. And so obviously this book was very important in spreading the news, and it sold out instantly. And I just think it would be interesting to find out who has copies and where they landed. And yes, Kansas, because in some senses it's a place that a lot of people think of as being hostile to Darwin and evolution, but indeed they have a couple of copies of the book.
Well, let's play this piece that you did. You went to University of Cambridge to find some original notebooks. But it was interesting to me because the American you went with certainly belies that notion of Americans being hostile to Darwin. He's about as enthusiastic as anybody I've ever
heard. Well, I'll make the distinction that scientists everywhere are embrace Darwin. It's a social issue.
And I mean, I was working with Joe on these pieces, and in fact, the American that you went with, it was all rather a great and fortuitous coincidence, wasn't it, when you found out he was going to be there?
Yeah, no, it was just one of those, you know, things falling into place. I was calling several people saying, I'm going to England, what should I do? And this guy said, well, I'm Mr. Sean Carroll, you'll hear. I said, well, I'm going, maybe you come along and we can look together.
Which is what they did. Let's hear it.
To tell the story of evolution, let's start at the beginning. The beginning of my trip to England, that is. It's Friday night, January 16th, and I'm on the campus of the University of Cambridge. We're in Lady Mitchell Hall, and Sean Carroll's about to give a lecture. This place is packed. Sean Carroll's day job is molecular biologist at the University of Wisconsin, but he's got the Darwin bug. He's written 3 popular books about Darwin and evolution. Is Darwin groupie too strong? Well, let's just say he didn't hesitate when he was asked to come to England and kick off the Darwin College Lecture Series.
Wow. 2009, here I am. Anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. Pinch me.
For an hour, Sean told a rapt audience how modern biologists studying evolution at the molecular level are proving Darwin more right than he could possibly have known in his own lifetime. The lecture was the start of a long weekend I spent with Sean, who agreed to help me understand how Darwin's theory evolved. But before we got to work, Sean was eager for me to meet someone at the reception after his talk.
Stephen Keynes.
And you're related to Charles Darwin Howe?
My grandfather was his second son.
So what did you think about Sean Carroll coming and giving a lecture in your great-grandfather's name?
It elucidated what he would have enjoyed about what's happened with his work fantastically. He would have enjoyed every moment of it.
Next morning, Saturday morning, we get to work.
Let's start with the ornithology notes.
Okay.
Because I'm keen on that, and I have notes as to exactly pages and things.
We're in a small room on the third floor of the Cambridge University Library. Allison Pern is with us. She's assistant director of the Darwin Correspondence Project, an effort to sort and publish all of Darwin's letters. Cambridge has a huge collection of them, as well as his field notes and papers. Sean's ordered up a slew of documents. He wants to show me just how early on Darwin begins to realize that over time, species change. He pulls out notes that the 27-year-old Darwin wrote on the way back to England on the Beagle. Darwin is speculating on why the different islands of the Galapagos each has a different kind of mockingbird on it.
Here's the killer. If there is the slightest foundation for these remarks, the zoology of archipelagos will be well worth examining, for such facts would undermine the stability of species. And this is his first observations related to understanding, starting to recognize that species change.
I should point out here that Sean is actually reading from transcripts he's brought with him. Darwin may have been a great scientist, but it takes practice to read his awkward scrawl. Next, Sean wants me to see a famous page from one of the little red notebooks Darwin filled after he was back in England. It's the famous Notebook B, where Darwin makes a sketch of a tree, the tree of life, with branches from a central trunk, illustrating the radical idea that species evolved from a common ancestor. But Sean's disappointed. Notebook B is too famous for mere mortals to see. All Allison can show us is a facsimile. But she does hand him the original Notebook M.
Page 36. Can I touch it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I can at least tell my kids. There's the difference, Joe, between facsimile, okay? These little red notebooks with their letters on them, colored, you can just see, easy to fit in a pocket. Anything occurs to them, flip it open, right on writing Stream of Consciousness, and he's burning through these notebooks in 1837 and 1838. It's just, the notes are just piling up. His mind is just gushing.
Sean says Darwin is now moving to the idea that the forces of nature alone can shape species, and that biology is ruled by natural laws just as physics and astronomy are. Holding the precious notebook, Sean reads from a transcript.
We can allow satellites, planets, suns, universes, nay, whole systems of universes, to be governed by laws, but the smallest insect we wish to be created at once by special act.
Sean says by putting an end to the notion that only a special act of a divine creator could be responsible for the marvelous variety of life on Earth, Darwin has come up with something that will be provocative, upsetting, heretical.
He knows that everyone wants every being to be specially created. This is what he's up against, the prevailing doctrine of special creation, that species are put instantaneously on the Earth in a particular place for a particular period of time. And not related, as he has deduced, by descent from ancestors.
Sean says Darwin's ideas continued to evolve, and by 1844 he had written draft language that almost perfectly parallels what will be in On the Origin of Species 15 years later. But he was in no rush to publish, because he knew he would take a lot of heat once his ideas were loosed upon the world.
He had the... You could call it the luxury to let this, to have this gestate for 20 years. But of course, every month he waited, there was a risk that someone else would come up with this idea.
And of course, someone did come up with the idea. Another one of Sean's heroes, a British naturalist named Alfred Russel Wallace, who had traveled to the Malay Archipelago in the 1850s. Sean was supposed to fly back to the States on Tuesday morning, but when he learns I'm going to see some of Wallace's papers at the Natural History Museum in London, he changes his flight to Tuesday afternoon so he can join me. At the museum, we find more historical treasures. Museum curator George Beccoloni pulls out another small 19th century notebook.
Owen, you might be interested to see this. This is Wallace's notebook from the Malay Archipelago.
Oh, my God.
From 1858.
Oh, my God. I didn't know it existed.
Sean says Wallace's notes and papers show he was thinking along identical lines to Darwin, albeit 20 years after Darwin's ideas began to coalesce.
He was finding different species on different islands. They were clearly related because they were all bird-winged butterflies. And what he was thinking was, well, gee, I'm finding these closely allied species near each other, so new species are evolving in the proximity of pre-existing relatives. And it's really a parallel line of thought to what Darwin was thinking about in terms of finches and mockingbirds.
History is given most of the credit for the theory of evolution by natural selection to Darwin. But Sean says Wallace deserves better, so be forewarned. We have 14 years to get ready for the 200th anniversary of Wallace's birth. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Well, we couldn't say much more about Wallace in that piece, but in fact, if you go to the web, we've got a sort of audio extra where Joe plays some of the interview that he did about why Wallace got left by the wayside. And there's also a slideshow where you can see the butterflies that Wallace was thinking about. Well, Chris, you know about this kind of thing. One of the challenges is when you're doing more than one piece about the same thing, it's trying to do very different kind of things.
Well, Robert Krulwich, one of our science correspondents, he's in the business of doing things differently. And we're going to play a piece that he's done. It's a different take on Darwin. It's about love rather than evolutionary biology.
Because one of the questions is, why did Darwin wait, well, over 20 years from coming up with his ideas about evolution to publishing them in The Origin of Species? And Robert wanted to try and find out why.
Before the big white beard, before he was famous, before his life in science, when Charles Darwin was just 28 years old, he wondered if it was time for him to get married. So what does he do?
Well, he makes a list of pros and cons.
And above the pros and the cons, says author Deborah Heiligman, Darwin wrote a title.
It's called Marry, Not Marry, This is the Question.
So on the why I shouldn't get married side, he lists loss of time, quarreling with the wife, anxieties of children.
He'd have to visit relatives.
Right.
And what if he didn't like them?
And on the pro side, what would he get if he did get married?
He would get, you know, a constant companion.
Mm-hmm.
And he said very famously that a wife would be better than a dog anyhow.
He literally wrote that?
He literally wrote that.
Better than a dog.
And the thing is, he loved dogs.
So that's a compliment, really. He wanted a wife.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh, so.
But there was one big question that he did not put on his list.
And what was that?
God.
God.
He really was beginning to think that he was having problems with God and with religion in general, and he knew that this was going to be a problem for pretty much every woman who he would want to marry.
Because every woman he wanted to marry was worried about a guy who had doubts about God. What was the problem?
Well, that your husband was going to go to hell and you would go to heaven, and I think there was a real fear that they would be separated for eternity, and that was painful.
But even so, when Darwin got interested in a girl he'd known his whole life, his smart but religious first cousin Emma Wedgwood, he decided whatever the problems, she's the one. So at some point he says, will you?
Yes. He finally asks her, and she's actually shocked. Because she thought...
She didn't see it coming.
She didn't see it coming. She thought they were first cousins. They were friends. She thought maybe they would go on like this for years. But she already knew she wanted to marry him. So even though she was shocked, she said yes immediately, which in turn shocked him.
So he gets a headache.
He gets a headache. They're both feeling miserable. They're both completely shocked at what they've done.
But they go ahead and they get married. And at first it's a little bit rocky because Darwin tells Emma about his theory of natural selection, which hints that God may not be absolutely necessary.
He did tell her at least some of the doubts that he was having. And she just was really, really worried about it.
So she wrote him a letter asking him to try harder to find his faith. And he agonized over that letter. There are actually several letters, but he wrote on the edge of this one, "When I am dead, know that many times I've kissed and cried over this."
He kept those letters with him all the time.
One question all Darwin biographers have to deal with is, why did Darwin wait so long, 21 years, to publish his ideas about evolution? Says writer Adam Gopnik,
"What is it? What causes that 21-year delay? And like all the significant things in life, there's no one answer. One of the reasons is he's collecting evidence. He never puts it aside completely. He's struggling to find evidence to persuade people that his idea is true. But at the same time, I don't think we're wrong to think that knowledge that it would hurt her, it would undermine her, it would pain her for him to publish these ideas is equally powerful."
So there was this real tension then between Darwin's marriage and Darwin's theory. And then Annie came along.
Annie was their second child, their oldest daughter, really the apple of their eye. I think she seemed to be a perfect blend of Charles and Emma. She was spirited, she was kind, she was musical like Emma, but she was orderly like Charles. They were just really, really close to her.
And then things took an opera-like turn.
Yeah, it is like an opera. She gets sick.
And the sickness is kind of mysterious.
They couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, and the doctor in London that they went to couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, and she would often cry at night, which was so unlike her.
So what happened?
Well, Annie just got worse and worse, and she finally died.
She was 10 years old. Darwin did not go to her burial.
So he didn't stay for the funeral. He couldn't bear it.
But Annie's death, instead of sharpening the deep differences between Emma and Charles, who after all felt so differently about the afterlife, strangely, their differences relaxed.
I almost feel like the death of Annie was so much the worst thing that could happen to them, and they survived it, that it was almost like anything else paled in comparison. So it was... Emma went on believing that she would see her loved ones in heaven. Charles, pretty much, that was it for him.
After Annie died, he became more willing to pursue and to proclaim his theories, and Emma turned toward him, not away from him.
Emma wrote to him, "You are my prime treasure and always have been."
If you read Darwin's book, says another biographer, Leanne de Haupt, you can feel Annie's influence on Darwin.
He knew so deeply and so personally and viscerally what death was now after Annie's loss. And yet in his writing, you see him affirming over and over this circle, the endless unfolding of life, as he expresses it in The Origin.
On the very last page of The Origin of Species, says Adam Gopnik, Darwin takes his readers to a beautiful forest rich with trees and birds singing everywhere, and he reminds us that the beauty that we see every day, the butterflies, the flowers, and especially we humans who can contemplate and love these things, We are all of us, products of millions of years of competition, struggle, famine, death. And that struggle will continue, so life will keep evolving new forms and new shapes.
Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows.
So hear that sentence one more time. Thus, from...
From the war of nature, from famine and death.
From famine and death.
The most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. Basically, what Darwin is saying is exactly what we now call the existential dilemma. That's what he's stating. He's saying there are two things that are true. One is that everything dies, and things die for no reason and to no apparent end, and their death is painful. And that process of living and dying produces something amazing and beautiful and astonishing.
And there's a grandeur in that.
And there's a grandeur in that.
There is a grandeur, says the final sentence of Darwin's book, in this view of life that even from death, even random death, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. Robert Krulwich, NPR News in New York.
One of the great things and the moving things about Darwin that I've always felt was that he could grasp and synthesize grandeur out of the small things in the world, the little things. For example, so much of what Darwin learned, he learned from watching the most insignificant animals on the planet, you might think, you know, finches, birds. And with that in mind, we're going to hear a little bit about birds to end our podcast this week. Correspondent Richard Harris has this story about some amazing experiments that were done with tracking devices that were put on small birds as they began and finished their huge and lengthy migration to South America and back.
Ornithologist Bridget Stutchbury fell in love with North American songbirds many years ago and has made a career of trying to understand how they manage their incredible voyages.
I've always been frustrated that they leave in the fall and disappear and then, as if by magic, show up in the spring, and we really have no idea where individuals go.
The biologist at York University in Toronto says it's possible to track really hefty birds.
Satellite transmitters have been used for larger birds like peregrine falcons, but those devices are way too big. They're almost the size of a songbird. They wouldn't go anywhere if you put one on their back.
So instead, she turned to a tiny gizmo that was invented by researchers at the British Antarctic Survey called a geolocator. It's half the weight of a dime.
These devices measure light. So you put them on the bird's back as a little backpack, and off the bird goes on migration. And when it comes back the next spring, you catch the bird, take the backpack off, and download the data onto your computer.
The computer can analyze a daily record of sunrise and sunset these birds experience during their migration and get at least some idea of where the birds have been, plus or minus a couple hundred miles. And Stutchbury and her colleagues now report in Science magazine it really works. They managed to track 5 wood thrushes from Pennsylvania to Central America and back. They also followed the flight of 2 purple martins, a type of swallow.
I was surprised that both of them spent most of the winter in the Amazon basin.
Up north, martins usually fly over wide-open fields, catching insects on the wing. But in winter, for some reason, they seem to head for the woods. Even more surprising was how fast one of those martins hightailed it back from the Amazon.
It flew back to its breeding colony in the northern U.S. in only 13 days. This is incredible. I had no idea that songbirds could go this fast.
Also surprising was the flight path of one of the wood thrushes she tracked. Ornithologists assumed that these birds fly straight home from Latin America, right across the Gulf. 4 of them did, but the 5th bird she followed actually took the long way around, flying up the coast of Mexico.
Presumably, this bird was in poor condition, and flying across the Gulf of Mexico usually requires a 12 or 14-hour non-stop flight over water. And if the birds run out of steam over the Gulf of Mexico and go in the water, they're doomed. They're going to die.
Now, this first successful experiment with songbird backpacks isn't simply a matter of curiosity. Stutchbury and other ornithologists are trying to figure out why some species of North American songbirds are in distress. Is it trouble here on their breeding grounds or trouble down south? Pete Mera at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center says these tracking devices could help them solve that mystery.
I actually think that the floodgates are open now, and I think a lot of people are going to be deploying these on as many species as they possibly can. I'm going to put on about 100 on wood thrushes this year across their entire range.
That could provide a clue about why one of the most melodious denizens of the northern woods is slowly fading away. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Well, we've had Darwin, we've had NASA, we have had songbirds, a little bit of the lowbrow from our Neanderthal friends, and I think that is it for the week. Thanks for joining us in our podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us a little bit about what you like and perhaps don't like in our podcast. Just email us at nprscience@npr.org, and we'd love to hear what you've got to say. Thanks for coming again, Allison.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm beginning to see why you guys like being on this side of the microphone.
See you next week.
Sigh.